What's up? What's up, everybody? Welcome to a brand new episode of Part of the Problem. I am Dave Smith. As always, I'm joined by the great, hilarious Robbie the Fire Bernstein. How are you, sir?
I am well, my friend. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm looking forward to going up to Toronto with you. You've got a little string of gigs weekend, right?
I got a wild amount of stuff. Assuming I get across the border, it'll be Burnett, New York on Thursday. Fans got a nice winery out there.
Stop adding this caveat into the plug. The point of doing a plug is to get people to come to the show. And then you go with it like, I mean, I guess if it happens, it'll be
well,
fun.
Well, all these other ones are definitely happening.
We're going to be in Toronto, too. That's the one I'm on. That's the one I care about. We're going to be there.
All right. Well, Burnett, New York, then opening for you in Toronto. Then I'm Detroit, Michigan, and then Pittsburgh, and then coming home on Monday. And I got a lot of porches all summer long. You go to porchstore.com, see the whole roster of them.
Hell yeah, dude. And I'm getting real excited for that Denver weekend, too. That's coming up soon, man. And we got we sold out every show last year. So we're hoping to do that again this year. If you're in the Denver area and you want to come out, grab tickets now because these are going to move. ComicDaveSmith.com and then PorchTour.com is your site, right, Rob? I got that right. You changed it a lot, but I remembered.
And I'm excited to not be home for any more weekends for a while because, my God, do I hate it.
Yeah, see, your home is a reflection of yourself, Rob, and you hate yourself. And this is why you have to try to run away. You have to try to run away from yourself all over the country. But you bring joy and laughter.
You get stuff done. It's just all the stuff you hate. It's like I was working all weekend, but it was getting myself out of laundry dead. It's cleaning up the piles you ignore all the time. And I'd rather just let the piles like grow and ignore them and then just be out and doing the comedy thing.
The thing is, like, I just look, there's something to that when you're on the road a lot, that always becomes part of life. It's like when you get home, you want to just be like, ah, I'm home. But really, when you get home, it's like, no, here's the 15 tasks that you can only get done now that you're home that you couldn't get done there. So, but I'll tell you what, having kids. All right, this is not going to sound like a good pitch for having children, but dads out there will get what I'm saying. There's something about when you have kids that you're just forced to submit. It's like the true concept of Islam, right? You're just forced to submit to the fact that that's just life. Life is always just doing some other stuff. There's no such thing as a break. There's no such thing as like, it's just like, as soon as you get home, it's just the list of shit you gotta do is never ending. You got paper. I built a gazebo this weekend, Rob.
Did you really?
Built a gazebo, yes.
Does that mean
I did.
You hired someone else to build a gazebo?
No, I built my dumb gazebo with my father-in-law. Dude, it nearly broke me, Rob. Like a big, huge one. It looks so good, though. I'm so proud of it. But that was my entire weekend. I mean, this thing was a humongous job. Anyway, okay, let's get into some stuff because there's a lot of stuff going on. All right, Rob, I know you've been reading the news on this a lot, as I have been today and over the last few days. Let's try to put this together as best we can, starting with last Thursday, where there is an Axios report that comes out that the deal is done. It's been agreed to. It's just waiting for Donald Trump to decide whether or not he's going to sign it. And the reporting indicated that this was a very favorable deal to the U.S. We, of course, were skeptical, to say the least. As we stand now on Monday, a clearer picture has started to emerge, Rob. And tell me from your reading of the news if you think I'm getting this right, okay? And I'm trying to be charitable to both sides here. I think Donald Trump is correct in saying that the deal was going very good. America was getting all the terms that it wanted. And the only issue was that as good as the negotiations were going, the Iranians were not involved in the negotiations. So Donald Trump had worked out a great deal with himself. But there is one problem with that. The Iranians don't agree to it. So after all of this reporting, the latest today here, now this is, just give a little caveat here, because there is, and I don't know if you saw this, Rob, but there is a little bit, at least from the latest I've been reading, a little bit of a gap between what the Post was reporting and what DropSite was reporting. And the Post was a little bit, and I trust DropSite more on getting what the Iranians are saying right, but the Post said the Iranians have walked away from all negotiations. Like, they're done. They're not negotiating. Really kind of blowing up this alleged ceasefire. Dropsite had a little bit more of a caveat in there where the quote they had was like, the Iranians are strongly considering walking away entirely from the negotiations. So it's not exactly clear what's true. But literally, Rob, over as far back as over the night, while the rest of us were sleeping, Donald Trump was tweeting that a deal is close and it's going to be very good for the American people. Today, it looks like the Iranians are entirely walking away. In other words, nothing was accomplished. Right back to square one. Absolutely no agreement on any of the major issues. And here's the last thing, and then I'll throw it over to you to give your thoughts. What is it all about? What has blown the whole thing up? Israel is not abiding by the ceasefire in Lebanon. After the president of the United States ordered them to, forbade them from bombing them anymore, they've continued just devastating the place, and this is what blew up the ceasefire. Tell me your read of what you think.
Well, I agree with you on the last and middle part, but I think I had the story a little bit differently, which was from what I was seeing, the U.S. actually came to the table with some big concessions, and then Donald Trump blew up the deal by saying, I gotta change some of these factors. So it seemed like there was actually some momentum towards a deal. Now, Iran did come back and say, hey, Israel's got to stop in Lebanon. That's a part of what's happening here. That's got to be a part of the ceasefire. And now as to what's going on, as the supposed ceasefire stands, it seems like the ceasefire itself is over. I guess the Iranians shot down a Reaper or some, one of those, the yes. Predator or the Reaper. America's claiming that that was not an international, it was in international waters. Iran is claiming otherwise. But yeah, I mean, we were saying last week, the biggest variable is whether or not Israel is going to play ball. Israel is not. And so for the moment, Iran is walking away. I mean, that's the latest.
Yeah, that's okay. So yes, no, you're right about there was reporting that there had been some pretty major concessions that were made by the Americans, and then Donald Trump came in. But then the latest, it's kind of hard to gauge exactly what happened in that period there. But the latest I know, yesterday, Fox News released the details of the deal that Trump was willing to, and it's right back to maximalist U.S. demands. And a day later, the Iranians have walked away. So there's just this game that's being played where Donald Trump is constantly lying and telling you that Iran really wants to make a deal. They're desperate to make a deal. The Iranians are making clear at every single phase that is not true, at least not if it's the deal that Donald Trump's talking about. And the truth is that, you know, the truth is that we had such a great deal with the JCPOA. I mean, again, not perfect, relatively. You know, as far as these things go. But we had actually relatively, you know, I'm going to say, within the realm of what could possibly be achieved, actually, it was a really good deal. And I actually hate Barack Obama much more than the average Trump supporter does, and with much more specific receipts. But if we're being honest here, just think about this, Rob, in the context of even the problems that all of the hawks right now are talking about, whether they'd mentioned 60% enriched uranium or whatever. It's like, okay, well, you had a deal where they were down to 3.25%, where there was an inspections regime, a non-Iranian neutral, in, you know, the IAEA, the like gold standard of nuclear inspections regimes in Iran, watching the whole thing. You had major concessions from the Iranians. You had some very minimal unfreezing of assets that already belonged to Iran. Like, it was a good deal. You had international buy-in to it. I mean, relatively speaking, compared to everything else and every other option with Iran, it was that. Donald Trump also had offers on the table that were improvements from the deal. Their Geneva negotiations, they had offered more than the JCPOA. He was also negotiating before both of the wars that he launched against them and could have gotten a better deal. But at this point, we still actually could get something that's a fairly reasonable deal that every American could absolutely live with. There's no reason that like right now you could get something like a pledge that Iran isn't going to develop nuclear weapons and, you know, an opening of the strait with them getting to maintain some level of control, or maybe they charge a little environmental fee or something like that for a little bit. But you know what? At least the world economy gets relieved and oil starts flowing through, and we could just make a deal and then say, we're going to guarantee that we won't attack you anymore. We're going to rein Israel in or not support them. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, if we were willing to do those things, we could get a reasonable deal that everyone could live with. The problem is Trump would be humiliated, you know? And he's not willing to do that for obvious reasons. But there's now we're back to where we've been this entire time, which is a very bad place. There's that Donald Trump's, I mean, Rob, how many bluffs have they called already on him? What does he do now at this point? Like, how many times can he go around this merry-go-round where he goes, we're going to totally destroy you unless you make a deal? And they're dying to make a deal because we've already destroyed them so much. So make the deal right now or we totally destroy you. And they go, no. And he goes, all right. But, that, you know, like, this is how many more of these before it's just like, you got to either do one or the other. I don't know. I mean, I don't really have an answer to that. I'm kind of shocked that they were able to do another round of it already.
Yeah, I think Donald Trump is kind of content to sit in the somewhat neutral ceasefire stage where there's limited strikes on both sides and just wait and see if maybe he somehow gains leverage. And I think the reality of the situation is he's just prolonging the problem. And at some point, gas prices are actually going to come up significantly, and then Donald Trump's going to have no choice but to basically make the deal that you just said. And the real loser in that is, well, Israel's the biggest loser. And then the U.S. also has a problem of, I think some of our regional partners are going to view us as significantly less reliable. But the real loser is going to be Israel. And I don't think Donald Trump is willing to change the reality until he's absolutely forced to. Which is going to mean either more of an all-out war with a massive devastation in the region, or such a bad trajectory for gas prices and midterms that, you know, he finally decides he has no choice.
You know, one of the things I worry about the most with all of this, and I guess my primary concern here is that, I mean, what the obvious, like, the maximalist catastrophic risks, which I'm not saying any of them are going to come true, but like the biggest concern is what you alluded to there at the end, like the war really, you know, a massive, like, you know, a massive bombing campaign where the, you know, huge numbers of people die and they respond by taking out a desalination plant or something, you know, like the fear of something really spiraling out of control, which I'm still hopeful won't happen, but you know, you do risk these things happening. And you've got a president of the United States who's threatened bridge and power plant day, and you got an IRGC who's threatened to respond in kind by taking out desalination plants. You know, they're threatening this, and so that's a real concern. But then, like, a secondary concern is almost, and I know I've made the comparison before to, like, the money printing in 2020, and then how we didn't really feel the price inflation until 2021, 2022. And it's what we're doing now with this blockade is almost like, I'm struggling for like the best way to articulate this, but essentially what we're doing is we're judging by the current pain. This policy, even though most of the pain felt by this policy won't be coming for months. You know what I mean? And so we're going, okay, gas is $4.25 right now. That's putting a strain on people. I mean, you know, that's what it is here in New Jersey. I don't know. It might be, you know, more expensive in California or someplace like that. But, you know, you're like, okay, so you're judging off this current. But essentially, as soon as you stop, like as soon as it gets bad enough that you finally have to stop, that doesn't mean the pain is over. That means we're going to just start feeling the pain of all of these months. And I don't know, Rob, this is above my pay grade, but you know, whatever you look at the numbers, what is it? It's 20% of global oil flows through the Strait of Hormuz and a huge percentage of fertilizer and other things. And like, okay, that's been blockaded now for like several weeks. What's the impact of that? I don't know. Seems like very risky, though. And we do live, however any of us feel about this, in such an integrated, such a globalized economy that I don't know. Like, I don't think it's irrational to really be concerned about how much devastation that could have to the entire global economy. All right. These are big numbers we're talking about here.
Yeah. Well, the chatter last week is just, this is not my specialty by a long shot, but that oil reserves have been drawn down and that's what was kind of keeping prices somewhat stable. And now we're coming to more of the breaking point of where you're going to see big increases. That kind of lined up with the fact that Donald Trump was seemingly looking to offer some concessions last week to end the war, even though he has now walked it back from that. But that was the storyline last week, is that we're hitting like kind of a crucial stage for when you're going to see oil increases. But I don't know how to look at oil charts and tell you whether or not that's accurate.
Yeah. No, same. That's why I said it's above my pay grade, but it does seem to be a big concern. You know, one other thing that I noticed last night, did you see the Trump's Truth Social post where he said it'll everything, just don't worry, everything will work out. It always does.
Yes.
And did you notice, because this is just something that I picked up on that I found kind of interesting, because I believe I'm almost like 99% sure he's said this publicly too, but he certainly said it to me privately several times. But this is the exact wording that Tucker Carlson claimed Donald Trump told him in their last meeting before. You know, if you remember, Tucker had gone to D.C. like a bunch of times in a few weeks to try to convince Trump not to launch this war. Isn't that something in hindsight, just to think about that? Like,
well,
Tucker tried. I'm sorry, I want to hear your thoughts, but he literally said that that's what Donald Trump said. And in a sense, this like confirms that Tucker was telling the exact truth, because that's his exact fit. But that is 80-year-old Donald Trump's rattling around in his brain that it always works out, man. So just like, whatever. Just go with it. Sorry,
well,
go ahead.
I laughed when I saw it, because I was like, man, this is the one time I've ever seen Donald Trump not want the attention. That I guess things are going poorly enough that he's like, guys, quit with all the reporting on me and what I'm doing. Just knock it off. But I guess that's where his positive sales outlook is, really meeting the end of its road, is in pretending like this will just sort itself out. And if you look at Donald Trump's history, listen, he's very wealthy. He's very successful. He's had some big losses over the years, and he's been able to just pivot and walk away and move on to the next thing.
And it always works out.
Yeah, but you can't do that here. Like, for example, when you tried to overtake the NFL and Trump FL or whatever that league blew up because of the moves he was making, you move on to the next thing. You kind of can't do that in global politics.
It's different when you start a war than when you try to start a business. It's just, they're not one-to-one comparisons, you know?
You don't get to declare bankruptcy and then just relaunch the next project and sell some ties and then sell some steaks and then sell some this.
Look, man, there just really is, though, and I think it's worth focusing on that. There is something different about where Trump is right now versus where Trump has been. And there is something really very fundamentally different about the leader that Donald Trump has been over the last year compared to the president that he was, you know, in his whole first term and even early in this term, where I've never really seen him at a point where he's just kind of like, I'm tanking in the approval numbers. I'm at my lowest approval ever. And I don't care. Like, I don't care whether or not this is getting back. He's openly saying he doesn't care about the economy. He doesn't care about these things. He's just kind of like, when I saw that he said the exact words that Tucker Carlson told me he said in that meeting, and that it was just, in a sense, I mean, look, I guess this is not exactly 1000% proof, but like when Tucker says he said this phrase and then he posts the exact phrase, you're like, oh yeah, he did say that. Okay. Not 100%, but like 99.9% obvious. And then I'm going, okay, Tucker is literally telling the exact truth about that. And I just think about what Tucker told me about like the times that he met with Trump, and there was something really eerie about it. But Tucker, I'm not revealing something private. He's talked about this publicly, but we've talked about it in private as well. That he was like, he's like, you know, like Tucker gets it. And Tucker's, you know that, like, just knowing who Tucker is, that, like, you know, when he went in there, I mean, he was pleading with Donald Trump. He was literally there, like, trying to do whatever he can. And so he's making all of the arguments, you know, and he's going, sir, these are the risks. This is going to, he said, this is going to destroy your presidency. This is going to destroy your coalition. This is going to destroy your legacy. Like, this is what's going to happen. And really, I mean, Tucker, you know, predicted very, you know, close to accurately what was going to happen. And what Tucker said was that it was like Trump kind of conceded the argument. Like, he was like, I know, but we're doing it and it'll work out. And, like, it always works out. And there's something kind of, and Tucker himself said, and somebody who is very close with Donald Trump, he said, he goes, he's like different. He's changed. And I don't know what, I'm not sure that doesn't like prove that he's blackmailed or something like that, but it does seem, for whatever reason, he has gotten to a place where he's just kind of like, look, my hands were tied on this one. I get what you're saying, but we're just going to do it and whatever, it'll all work out. Looks like I'm probably not going to heaven, but, like, you know, whatever. But just to keep in mind, right, you know, when people say that every other president resisted the pressure for this war, you know, this is kind of open now, Rob. This has become like a completely accepted by all factions, including both of the secretaries of state under Barack Obama. Joe Biden has confirmed this, but the secretaries of state, I don't know if Obama himself has, but certainly a lot of people around him, that, you know, all these other presidents, that Benjamin Netanyahu's always trying to get you to overthrow the government of Iran, which is kind of easy to believe. He's testified before Congress that we should do it. Why wasn't he also testifying before presidents in private that we should do it? But just keep in mind that in that list of presidents who resisted the pressure to be pulled into this war, that also includes Trump in his first 4 years. And there were several, you know, when you just had mentioned this drone that just got shot down, and the dispute is over whether it was over Iranian territory or international waters, this exact same thing happened in Trump's first term, and they tried to suck him into the war there. And then they got him into the Soleimani strike, and after the Iranians responded, they tried to suck him into the war there, but he managed to resist it. You know, this second term, something changed. And, man, did he make a big mistake.
Yeah, well, it's that part of Donald Trump, which is a bit of a baby, but it's my way in the highway. I need full loyalty. I need everyone on board. And I guess my read is, it seems like he's got to be blackmailed or something's happening here. But there is just the element of Donald Trump's own hubris. And he got into this thing and he's not leaving without a win. And we're just kind of seeing everything kind of play out from there.
And that is the Jonathan Pape escalation trap, you know, that essentially you got to get a win. And that's what keeps, you know, it's like your foot's in the quicksand and you're like, I got to pull it out with my hand. Now your hand and foot are in the quicksand. So you got to pull it out with your other hand, and you got, you know, and you just keep getting sucked into it. I do, Rob, I kind of have to take a second here, which, as you know, this has become in some ways like something that I can't stop talking about lately, but it's just so, you know, blatantly egregious. But the Trump supporting influencers, I'm sure you could make a comparison, but it's almost, I guess I would compare them to almost like the way I felt about woke late night TV show hosts through the rise of wokeism, where you'd almost look at these people who, you know, you had kind of previously, whatever you thought of Jimmy Kimmel or Stephen Colbert or, you know, some of these guys, or even some of the people like Rachel Maddow and stuff like that. But, like, no matter what you had thought of them in previous iterations, you probably would have recognized them as like human beings. You know, they're human beings with souls and thoughts and opinions and whatever. And then you would just watch them, like, just toe the party line, even when the party line became the most ridiculous shit ever, and you just like kind of like lose respect for them. But some of the, I mean, dude, listening to like Scott Jennings and Jack Posobiec and Will Chamberlain and some of these guys, literally the Axios report comes out on Thursday that we're close to a deal, and they all immediately take to social media. Historic win for Donald Trump. He did it against all of the naysayers. On the sixth go around of this, when they've been burned five times in the last, 8 weeks, they still just right away jump on board trying to sell the message when it is so obviously going to blow up in their face in 2 days. And then they'll just go about their days like nothing happened. I mean, I pull up some of these. I think I bookmarked a couple of them. Scott Jennings, looks like a huge win for President Trump and the U.S. Hearing from a senior admin official, this report is true. All capital letters, T-R-U-E, true. And the U.S. appears to be getting everything we want. 3 days ago, Rob. Everything we want. Do you know what we actually ended up getting, Rob? Nothing. Now, there's, for some of the more astute listeners, there's a pretty large gap in between everything we want and absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. And Scott Jennings will just literally, these people, he will be just as smug today as he was the day that he announced that. You know, he will sit there with his suit and his smile and sit across the room and be like, I know exactly what's going to happen here. You guys worried about this are all being ridiculous, and pretend that he just wasn't that completely wrong. I don't know what to say. And look, dude, all these guys, and some of them, like, I never even had nothing against, Jack Posobiec and or some of these guys, but it's just like, how can you not just look at this and go, you guys are like, you're essentially Colbert doing a vaccine dance right now, dude. I'm sorry. I know they're slightly different topics, but what is this other than just, hey, the orders came down today. This is the story we're going with today. And we're going to try our best to con as many people into believing this. Now, what are you doing? It's a historic victory. Your fucking president lied you into a war on behalf of the Israel lobby, and he's lied to you a million times since. He's a bumbling retard. He is just, this is a level of humiliation that George W. Bush and Barack Obama never did to themselves while conducting a war, is where Donald Trump is at this point. Announcing bridge and power plant day, announcing that war is over, now there's a deal now, and every last one of them turns out to not be true. I don't know, Rob. It's unbelievable to see people like this.
Propaganda's a nice paycheck, and that's why they get paid the big bucks, and it's not like any of them are going to lose their jobs over it, so, they can keep on. Like we've said before, you might as well just listen to the press secretary. What's the point of these people if they're just repeating whatever's coming from them with no critical thought and just selling it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Exactly right. I mean, it's I remember there was I just watched a segment on the Young Turks. It was Anna Kasparian did a segment, and she did like a deep dive on Emily Austin, one of the like. She's like one of the young blonde girls who's just like a professional Hasbro fucking peddler. And, I've like I was on a Piers Morgan panel with her once, and I know Scott Horton was on a Piers Morgan panel with her once. And I knew that she was she was one of the influencers in the Netanyahu, when he was talking about the acquisition of TikTok and all that. She's one of the $7,000 club people or whatever. But then Anna goes through this whole thing. I didn't know any of this about her, but Anna goes through this whole thing where it's like, oh no, dude, she was like, this chick is like an operative. Like she had admitted to being a spokesman for the government of Israel. She was like, defined herself as like a Hasbro spreader, like pre October 7th and all this. She was friends with like highest level Likud party members and was repped by the agency that reps all of these like Hasbro, like she's like, oh, you're something much more approaching a foreign spy than I actually realized. But anyway, so there's literally aside. So I just saw this, but there's only two things I know about her that she just had these moments. So she had one moment where she debated Scott Horton, and she had one moment where she debated May. And in one of them, she Scott goes off on this whole rant about the difference between uranium and plutonium bombs and the actual logistics of like building a bomb. And then she responded by saying something about, you just don't understand how dangerous Khomeini is. And then Scott goes, he's been dead for decades. And then she goes like, oh. Like, she literally just, like, she just thought the first Ayatollah was still the guy who ruled Iran. And Scott was like, he died in like the 70s, blah, 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 whatever. And Scott also, of course, knew the month and the year that he died and the manner. But like, and then she just scoffed. Like, it was just, and then I had a moment with her. She's literally like a chick who, like, I think it's almost like, if it makes sense, like, she was like the pothead at Hasbro University. Like, she didn't go to class that much, but she remembers a couple things that she heard. There was, so when I was debating her, she goes at one point, there's a clip of this. It went kind of viral on the internet. But at one point she goes just like, well, I don't know. I mean, you describe, you know, Israel as an occupying force, but how come you never say anything about Egypt occupying Palestine or Jordan occupying Palestine? And I was like, well, the reason why I don't really focus on the Egyptian occupation of Gaza or the Jordanian occupation of the West Bank is because they both ended in 1967.
Just good reason.
Oh, okay. she knew somewhere that like that was a talking point of some sort, but like she didn't realize what, you know what I mean? Like she didn't even know like how to say it. Anyway, this chick is like a real deal, like fucking one of their people that they put out there. And you're just like, I don't know, there's something about it where it's like, oh, you guys really were always this bad at this. It's just that you had the system rigged. And that's really seems to be what's, you know, kind of coming apart about this. Anyway, speaking of the Young Turks, did you see that? Now, I got tomorrow, Cenk Uygur is coming on the show.
Ooh, fun.
But yeah, which I'm very interested to talk to him about this and some other things. But did you see, evidently Cenk Uygur got, he's banned from the United Kingdom. He was going over there. I guess they were doing like a South by Southwest thing, and he was giving a speech at Oxford or something. Maybe it was Oxford. I can't remember.
Just for the sake of accuracy, I'm not sure if it's a permanent ban or they just denied him entry.
Well, they denied him
for
entry
this particular occasion.
Fair enough. But yes,
and unclear if he wanted to go as a tourist for a different occasion, if they would approve it. But
sure, sure, sure. So, okay, yeah, I mean, that's fair. That's a fair point. Yes, yes. No, but still, I mean, it's pretty wild to think that, like, wait, now the United Kingdom is barring Americans from traveling there due to their opinion of Israel. I mean, geez. Again, it's just like I don't know. It's like all of the goddamn Zionist propaganda over the last few years, even this one, you almost sit there and just go, all right. Who do you think that's a bigger win for ultimately? Right? Like, okay, yes, you denied Cenk speaking at one gig. Like, and there's also something kind of like by the nature of podcasting that it's like, okay, yes, he doesn't get to speak live to like 1,000 people or something, but now he gets to go back to his gigantic platform and talk about it to like 1 million people who, you know what I mean? Including probably all the people there, unless you're going to ban the internet in the United Kingdom, then, you know, you're going to have a problem. And so anyway, it's just like, oh, you just clearly make it look like what it is, that you're trying to silence dissent and that somehow one foreign country is off limits for criticism, which really is insane when you think about it. I mean, we don't even think about these things when I say all types of criticism of of English policy, British policy on, you know, arresting people for tweets and Muslim rape gangs and crazy like immigration policies. See all types of criticism of America from every single angle. See criticism of every country. And yet there's just this one that is like it's a criminal act of sorts to criticize them. How do you think this helps you guys? It's just like, it's unbelievable how bad they are at propaganda.
Well, they're atrocious at propaganda, but they're very good at the actual government legislation side of things. Yeah. And they, you know, are decent at the internet censorship with purchasing TikTok. I mean, generally speaking, they're losing the war. But I think this falls into the old world mentality a little bit of, if you buy your media and opinions from official channels, this does boost like the credibility of, oh, this guy's dangerous. This person's so dangerous, the UK wouldn't let him in for a speech. And, you know, you accumulate enough of these like badges of this person's dangerous, or look how dangerous his perspective is. In an old world, that could kind of work to trick normies that this person either needs to be censored, is actually a dangerous person, has radical opinions, et cetera, et cetera. In the podcast landscape, that's just not working. And I guess in that regard, you know, they're still trying old tricks. Think about it. 20 years ago, if you heard, oh, wow, there's an American media broadcaster saying things so horrible that the UK won't let him in, and you can't actually go, you know what I mean? You can't readily access his materials. You might go, oh, wow, that guy must be a real horrible person. Like, that could have worked on you. It doesn't work now, but, you know, who knows?
No, it's,
who knows what more censorship they can pair it with, though, and suddenly it starts working.
Look, you're right. You're absolutely right. I mean, that's the dynamic, right? Is that they're no good at this propaganda campaign outside of the controlled environment. And they're still good at it for the age of people who don't get their media from, you know, alternative media sources. And so they can still convince boomers with Fox News propaganda. But yeah, it's just so bad. They just die a sudden, like a human being who's put in outer space without a spacesuit or something like that. You're just like, you are not evolved to survive in this environment. And it's that simple. However, in the environment of getting laws passed and wielding power, they're in their element. And perhaps the inverse is true about us, that we're human beings in outer space when it comes to that environment.
And luckily in this case, I don't mean luckily. They're not going to have to own it, because I think the official reason was it was against the public good. I don't know that they further explained that. I saw somewhere, I guess, that it was that there's already too much anti-Semitism in the country. But typically speaking, you know, Donald Trump might go, who the fuck do you think you are, England? You're to tell us our people can't come into your country and give speeches. But in this case, Donald Trump has no interest in that. And and I don't live in England, so I don't know to what extent their propaganda or censorship laws are working on the general population. So, you know, might not help their case in this country, but maybe it's working over there.
Yeah. And we'll see. It is interesting. Like, I even saw there was someone, I don't know, it was like the chief financial officer or something like that at Daily Wire came at me the other day, called me retarded on Twitter. And then
hey, chief financial officer, look in your numbers.
Yeah, well, I said something like, send the best guy you got from the collapsing Daily Wire. And let's see how retarded I am. And then I said, oh, yeah, that's right. All of you are fucking bitches. And none of you will come. Because, you know, this is what I'm on with the Daily Wire guys when they talk shit about me anymore. Okay. Yeah, just like, enough. You guys have talked shit. Every last one of your biggest hosts have fucking talked shit about me. Not one of you are willing to come see me. So, like, that's just it. Then shut up and move on, or come do it and see what's up. But I mean, it's not even like they sent one of their guys. It's just like he doesn't have like a Twitter front. It's just fucking everyone's just trashing them. And you're like, I can't believe you guys can't even. How do you guys not come up with like a company strategy here? You'd be like, don't just have a random account throw pot shots here. But anyway, I did want to talk about what he claimed was so retarded, because we mentioned this a little bit. But I just think, even as the dust settled, I had made, it was one of the clips from when I recorded with Liam McCollum, where I had basically said, you know, like, I really think Thomas Massey could do something huge by running for president here. Like, I mean, I think he's got a great track. And I got into an argument on Twitter with Orrin McIntyre about this, and who I like very much, but I really disagree with him on this. It's funny because people want to like laugh this off, like, oh, that's ridiculous. And essentially it seems like all they have to say is that, hey, you lost a primary in Kentucky, so obviously that you can't win the presidency. And I got to say, I'm kind of shocked by what like, it's just such a low resolution analysis of the real dynamics that are going on here. It's like, okay, first of all, Thomas Massie didn't just lose a primary. Thomas Massie won 7 consecutive primaries by huge margins in this district. And then only after the absolute full court press of more money from the Israel lobby pumped in than has ever been pumped into a congressional campaign ever, a full Fox News blockout, the president going on a rampage, sending the Secretary of War to go give speeches. Only after a full court press did they manage to unseat him. And all it really worked to do was work on the boomers. It just made the younger people love him even more. Now, several things are true here. That's going to be very hard to scale to a presidential race. Okay? I mean, you do the math on it, Rob, but like, even someone like Miriam Adelson could send $32 million into a little district in Kentucky, but like, she can't send $32 million into every little district in the United States of America. I don't know exactly what the math on that would be, but you're talking about like, this is going to be in the billions or tens of billions of dollars. That's a different proposition. And again, the Fox News blackout is one thing for a small congressional primary race, but a presidential race, that's a whole different thing. You tell me, do you see a world where Thomas Massie runs for president and he isn't doing all the podcast circuit and just doing huge, huge shows constantly? It's going to be very, very hard for even Fox News these days to block that out. And then you go, Rob, look, dude, the fucking, at least according to that latest Daily Mailer piece, who knows, but they're saying J.D. Vance isn't even going to run. I'm pretty convinced that Marco Rubio is going to be the fucking the nominee that's backed by the administration and the establishment. Because, you know, just think about it, Rob, who really makes the decisions here? But it seems to me like it's Miriam Adelson. And if Miriam Adelson is really making the decisions, or at least has a lot of influence, I think Marco Rubio ends up being the one, not J.D. Vance, who they get behind. And, you know, unlike most presidents, Donald Trump has not committed to "I'll support my vice president." So anyway, you're telling me, dude, Marco Rubio, little, weird-looking, uncharismatic Marco Rubio is going to run in a Republican primary against America First, anti-Israel lobby, you know, proponent of exposing deep state criminality, Thomas Massie? I think everything about the voting patterns of the Republicans over the last decade suggests that he would have a serious lane that he owns there. I don't know. People are saying this. I think this is like, he's the guy, and it's the best thing we could hope for right now.
Yep. I think, listen, these people are just being dismissive. It's the same crap as the Donald Trump thing. You know, they're trying to pretend, hey, you're a bunch of losers, you like, this thing's over. But I mean, in the general elections, you got to capture more than just the 30% of hardcore Republicans that are completely locked in with Trump, and Trump's going to be gone anyways. I don't think anyone really picks up just the MAGA title. Donald Trump did run on being anti-war. He ran on a lot of America First things. If you're Marco Rubio, you're now the old school Republican establishment who, if anything, guided Donald Trump into all the things you were hoping this administration wouldn't be. And then you got the guy who fought for the Epstein transparency, talked out against this war, has talked out against these, changes to food with the glyphosate and then the other stuff. I just think every single talking point's in Massey's favor, and he's got more of an opportunity for independence, for reaching Democrats. I mean, if you end up with like a Newsom or an AOC, I could see a lot of Democrats just preferring what Thomas Massey's running on. So,
dude, absolutely.
It's the same cheerleading, dismissive stupidity of these people of just, hey, look, he lost in Kentucky. Can't possibly. All right, well, I think that was almost the entire point was, wow, they managed to rig this tiny district because you got a bunch of old people and they spent this much money. You're not contending with what we're actually saying, which is this guy is more popular than what that reflects. And you might have even given him a boost in terms of running on the national stage.
Absolutely. You know, and I would just add to that, And this looks, first off, Thomas Massie's a young man. He's not starting to run for president the age Ron Paul is. I mean, Thomas Massie could have multiple runs in him if he wanted to. And I do think, and I'd even, you know, I don't want to overstate something here. So maybe I'll even ask Natalie to like check if we can get numbers on this. But something that is going to become a factor here is that boomers are dying. And they're not like all going to be gone. But I mean, I literally just mean this, like maybe not even by 28, but like by 32, how many boomers are less are we going to have? Like Natalie, Google how many boomers die each year in America. Curious what the number is for that right now, right? Because it's got to be like, I'm just saying, like there might be millions less people in that category of voters and millions more people in the young people category of voters. Now, obviously the boomers show up at a higher rate still, but still, if you're peeling off millions of people, like that's going to make a pretty big difference. And, you know, there's, you know, if you were looking at, again, 28 is a long way off. And so who knows what can happen between here and now. But if you're looking at candidates like on the Democratic side, as you mentioned here, like AOC or Gavin Newsom, or even if you saw like a wild card, like a Stephen A. Smith type or something like that. But if you know, you could consider maybe Bobby Kennedy running again, but I just don't think there's any energy behind that at this point. And Thomas Massie being a legit, no fooling, critic of the Israel lobby, the warfare state, the Epstein class, like all of this with all the street cred in the world, I think would have massive appeal amongst some left-wing people, even young liberal people, like all types. You know, there really could be like a huge coalition that could be found there. You know, the country is not at all where the boomer Republicans are. 5,000 a day are dying right now. All right. Oh man, that's going to be a lot of math to get to what I wanted to. Yeah. So like, I mean, look, maybe this is more a factor by in 32 or 36 or something like that, but it's still something to keep your eye on. And I don't know. Yeah. Like you said, people are just being dismissive, but the truth is this is the guy taking the America First position on every last one of these issues. And every last one of the issues that he's running on are widely popular with the, or excuse me, I should say, every last issue that got him into so much trouble are actually issues where the overwhelming majority of the people are with him.
My quick math is that's close to 4 million less boomers by the time the next election comes around. And
1.8 million a year. Is what they're saying. Yeah. So that's right around there.
And what was the winning margin in most elections? It's not 4 million people.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, that's a huge, you know, you peel off a few million boomers and Republican primaries move a little bit. Like if you had peeled off a percentage of boomers in his congressional district, that changes everything. And one of the other things is that this kind of political martyrdom that, you know, in a, you know, metaphorical sense, Thomas Massie has been put in, this actually made him more popular with the younger people. So like his numbers were higher than ever before with young people. He is maybe the most popular political figure amongst young people in the country right now. And that's always a powerful thing because look, it is true that young people don't show up to vote in as young people as a broad demographic are less of a reliable voter than boomers are. Boomers vote. They will show up and vote. Young people get flaky on you. But at the same time, you're what any like national campaign needs is like a base of energetic grassroots organizers and activists. And that is almost always exclusively young people or overwhelmingly young people, because those are the people who have the passion and the time to do something like that. Whereas older people got like families and mortgages and shit, and it's harder for them to join a political campaign or, you know, phone bank or knock on doors or do stuff like that or make viral social media content. You need young people, that young energy for that. And he's going to have that in spades. And the other thing about Thomas Massie, man, is that, look, there's a reason why his opponent refused to debate him. And the, you know what I mean? Like, Thomas Massie's good at that. He's good at explaining things. He's good at exposing bad guys. He's good on a microphone. He's good at doing a podcast. Like, he's a really good messenger of a lot of these points. And yeah, I mean, I just think, like, I'd look at that and think there's enormous potential in a Thomas Massie run. And I think that, listen, I'm not even saying, like, essentially what I said the other day in that clip was that I go, he could win. He could win this. But even if he doesn't, this wouldn't be something like a Ron Paul run or a Pat Buchanan run in terms of how big it is. It would be something like a Bernie Sanders run. It would be like a, like, as if the libertarians would have their Bernie Sanders moment at the very least, I think, if Thomas Massie ran, which would mean like it'd be this enormous thing. It'd have a ton of energy behind it. There'd be a ton of young people. It would get the message out to like millions of people. And really quite possibly change the trajectory of where people's political, you know, worldviews head. And then whenever you're looking at these things, it's going to be a grassroots base of support that support Thomas Massie, and it's going to be the powerful and the wealthy who oppose him. And okay, power and money tends to win out in American politics, but not always. And that doesn't mean he can't win, and it doesn't mean he couldn't do something really huge that could really, I mean, I think, help shape the future of the country. So I'm all about it. I'm all about trying to get him to do that.
I certainly hope he does it, because it's exciting, and I'd like to see that story play out, and perhaps we're so enamored by him, we expect him to do better than he'll actually do. And that certainly is a possibility. I'm not always the best gauge of other people's stupidity and their interests.
Sure.
There's a lot of things that the general population really loves that I don't understand. Taylor Swift being just one example. But you know, I'm excited for it. I want to see it happen. And if it turns out that that's not the vehicle for changing the government, you know, I won't take it as a personal loss. But I think there's enough to work with there that I think it's a legitimate possibility, and it would be a missed opportunity if it's not tried.
Yeah, and I would just say to libertarians, to people who, with whatever is, libertarians at the moment, I kind of think are like stronger than we've ever been in terms of having like a cultural presence in the national conversation. And there is a certain degree of like, I think that, In the online world right now, particularly when it comes to like foreign policy, government corruption, things like that, you're almost like, you kind of have to come through a lot of these ideas at this point. Whereas it used to be that people were able to just ignore them. And we have, you know, just, we have more figures with big shows doing big things than we've ever had before. Obviously, the state of the party is a bit of a mess. But we've got, there's the Free State Project in New Hampshire, which has been able to do a bunch of things, really, honestly, been very incredibly successful so far. There's been major like homeschooling movements. We've got huge podcasts that a lot of people listen to. We've had local wins with things like Defend the Guard but literally, I think almost every libertarian right now would recognize that literally, and I mean, no, with all of those things that I just mentioned, so much of what we have, not saying everything, but so much of what we have is because Ron Paul ran for president twice. Like, this is just a fact that, and Rob, you know this very well, right? If you go into almost any libertarian thing, now this is a little bit, it's not a completely honest sample survey, you are you after all, but if you go into almost all these libertarian things and you were to say like, hey, rate show of hands, how many people are here because they found libertarianism through Ron Paul, were introduced to these ideas or converted? It's going to be a huge percentage. And I'm not saying it's everyone, but it's going to be a third of the whole fucking movement or something like that, you know? I think I have almost no doubt in my mind that like the Free State Project would be much weaker if Ron Paul hadn't run for president. Like a lot of people learned about it that way and then found out about the Free State Project and then moved there. a lot of people wouldn't be doing the Ron Paul homeschool curriculum, obviously, if they hadn't found through Ron Paul. And like, so again, these were presidential campaigns where he lost, where he didn't have the youth or all of the technological and media advantages that Thomas Massie has. From my perspective, looking at it like that, it's like, if we think that like having a stronger, like having more libertarians, having a stronger presence of people with libertarian ideas, if you think that that might be helpful toward the end of a more free society, which it seems to me obviously has to be part of it, I don't see anything we could do that would be like more bang for your buck than have one of our best guys with an amazing track record standing on the most important issues and just being right about all of them and exposing, who knows? I mean, he could expose tens of millions of people to these ideas. So I'm all for it. I think it's absolutely worth doing. And if he's willing to do it, man, we could make some noise.
Dude, a Massie Rubio debate in the primaries would be just be so great.
I mean, dude, what? And think this through for me. You know, like really play this out. Like, okay, if it ends up being Marco Rubio versus Thomas Massie, which look, no guarantee it will, but that seems like the most likely at right now to me. All right, I get it. I get Rubio's going to have the Adelson money and Rubio's going to have the establishment, but like, yeah, Rob, what happens if he has to see him in a debate? Like, really? Get up there and defend this war in Iran in a couple years. No, it was really great that we did that. We had to. Like, okay. And all Thomas Massie, you know, has to do is like, let me tell you what we're going to do. Everything Donald Trump said, except this time we mean it. Except this time we're not going to sell you out. We're done fighting these wars. America is not fighting stupid, unwinnable wars anymore. And I actually mean it because I'm Thomas Massie. And you know the Epstein files? My first order as president is going to be to have the CIA and the NSA declassify everything they have. We're going to force the Justice Department to give us the other 3 million files. And you know what? We're doing JFK and 9/11 too. We're going through all of this. I mean drain the swamp when I say that. That's the difference between me and Donald Trump. I mean drain the swamp. And you know what drain the swamp means? Ending the printing money machine. And you know what all these Democrats call unaffordability? Hey, let me talk to you, our Democratic friends. That is called monetary policy. That's what you're talking about. This is what happens when you devalue your currency. You know all those stupid wars we fought? We can't afford them. And we couldn't tax you enough or borrow enough from them. So we've just been printing the money. And that's why none of you can afford to live anymore. I mean, there's a pretty big lane there for that, wouldn't you say? You know, Orrin McIntyre, again, who I like, but he said to me on Twitter, he goes, oh, Dave, you guys are so delusional. Like, you'll never learn. It's just like I had to tell the DeSantis people. And you're like, dude, DeSantis? DeSantis had to try to take the throne from Donald Trump while he was being persecuted by the Democratic administration before he had betrayed his entire voter base. Thomas Massie's going up against Little Marco. Little Marco Rubio has run for president before. Do you know how he did? He fell flat on his face. He's much more comparable to Kamala Harris. You know, like Trump is Barack Obama. Marco Rubio is Kamala Harris. There's no comparison between trying to take the throne from those two people. It's a totally different lane. And also, DeSantis was running essentially in the pro-war lane against Donald Trump, refusing to speak out against the war in Ukraine and then totally capitulating to everything having to do with Israel. So I'm sorry, these two things are not the same. And I think you're missing the bigger themes right now. Like, you know, do you know how much desire there is for a serious presidential candidate who's critical of Israel, critical of the U.S. relationship with Israel, and critical of the wars we fight over them? You know how much like desire there is for that right now? Who's the other serious one? Who's going to fill that lane? You explain that to me. You're telling me there's this wide open lane. The majority of the country wants this, and nobody's going to fill this lane. Okay. Well, what happens when one person does? You know, just saying. What happened when one person filled the we don't want illegal immigration lane? It was pretty big. All right. We're going to wrap up on that. See you guys this weekend in Toronto and other places where Rob Bernstein will be.
PorchTour.com, Burnett, New York, Byron, Michigan, Pittsburgh, and then White Bear Lake, Minnesota. PorchTour.com.
Hell yeah. All right. Catch you guys tomorrow. Peace.